I want to welcome everybody to the Labor Beat Radio Show. My co-host, J.B. Christensen, is on his way to Virginia Beach, and I don't think he's going to be able to reliably call in. But I'm hoping that our Chicago representative will call in here soon. And today we have a special guest, Gene Bruskin, and I'm going to basically allow him to introduce himself a little bit, because he has some self-promotional material, I believe, also that he might want to share with us. But Gene, so the reason that I got interested in having Gene on the show was had to do with the significance of a production he's currently involved in about John Brown, of course, well known here in the Harpers Ferry region by reputation. Rising from the dead. And it just struck a chord in me because I remember, and I'll just be my little opening here, invitation to you to go forward here, Gene. But I remember reading a long time ago, I think, a biography of John Brown written by W.E.B. Du Bois, in which the sources of Du Bois's commentary were a lot of letters and correspondence between himself and Frederick Douglass, and which included a number of accounts by Frederick Douglass beyond his speeches at different times of his encounters with John Brown and the transition in opinions about how the issue of slavery would end up being resolved, and how Frederick Douglass became persuaded that John Brown was correct, that there was no peaceful way to overthrow the slaveocracy in the South. And this had profound implications for the rise of the labor movement at the time in kind of complicated ways as well. And but it raised a question that's I'm sure on a lot of people's minds in the labor movement today, considering the dire needs of many sections of what we might call our working class in the United States, compared with the political crisis. The system appears to be in considerable political crisis, and the gaps and divides between Americans by class, by race, by some other issues, but certainly by class, is looking like it has no peaceful resolution. So in some ways the spirit of John Brown asks an important question that I think all of labor facing their potential big strike in auto and a lot of conflict going on are asking. So with having said that, that just intrigued me, the John Brown story. And I'm going to ask Gene to introduce himself a little bit, talk about where he's been and his little biography in labor. And in labor-related struggles. So, Gene, take it away. And thank you so much for joining us today. And I'm so sorry for the interruptions that occurred with our technical disaster last week. But thank you for hanging in and joining us this morning.
Thank you, John, for having me. Technical disasters seem imminent on the whenever we're on these internet kind of deals. But it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to be able to be reaching out to the Harpers Ferry area about John Brown. I've been to Harpers Ferry many times from my spot in Silver Spring, Maryland. But in terms of my background, you know, I when I was younger in the 70s, I started doing community theater. But partly I needed a job and got a job driving a school bus during desegregation busing. And they cut our pay dramatically, and we organized a union, went on strike. I went to jail. I ended up becoming the president of the union in we built quite a local union there in Boston during all this uproar, bringing black and white workers together. And I spent about 10 years driving a bus and working with others to build that union. And eventually, I ended up getting job offers in D.C. and spent a couple years working for Jesse Jackson as his labor deputy. Spent, you know, maybe about 10 years in one of the departments, AFL-CIO, learning and helping to run strategic campaigns for unions that were in different kind of fights and a lot of different unions. Eventually, I was the coordinator for the Justice at Smithfield campaign, which is a North Carolina fight at a slaughterhouse with 5,000 workers that had been going on for quite a while. I came in the last 3 years, starting in 2006, and we were able to get a contract for that giant plant. People were under horrible conditions. And my last few years, I worked at the Teachers Union in a national office at the AFT, helping them do sort of research and strategy for organizing and contracts. And then when I retired, I'm still sort of doing various kinds of consulting, formally and informally, with Amazon workers and others. But my main shift that I wanted to do was to go back to what I started in the 70s, doing theater. And I'm now working on my third musical. My first was called Pray for the Dead, a musical tale of morgues, moguls, and mutiny, which we performed around Maryland at various union meetings and union trainings and so on. My second one was called The Moment Was Now. That one was about Reconstruction, took place in 1869, and brought together William Silvis, who was a white guy, grew up in Indiana, Pennsylvania, who was the president of the National Labor Union at that time that had 200,000 members. A guy named Isaac Myers, who was a shipyard worker in Baltimore, who worked at the same shipyard that Douglas escaped from and was organizing workers. Susan B. Anthony, who at that point in her life was a suffragist, but she was also organizing women workers. Lastly, a woman named Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, who was an author and an organizer and a speaker. And so the play sort of revolves around, now that the war is over, Civil War is over, the Industrial Revolution's here, how do we build a unified working class? And it was all done in music, you know, taking their words and making a song out of it. However, our final performance was March 8th, 2020, where we got shut down completely by COVID. We got a really good film that's available that a lot of people ask me about and do events around that film, because it was well done the way the cameraman did it, a great job of edits. So since then, under COVID, when there was no live theater, I wrote this play called The Return of John Brown. And it imagines that unexplainably, John Brown comes up out of the ground right where he was hanged in Charleston.
Right.
It wasn't a West Virginia at that moment, but and he gets rearrested, because the local sheriff and one of the local farmers thinks he's going to stir up the Black Lives Matter crowd. Now, that nobody knows how he could possibly be John Brown, but he says he's John Brown, and he looks like John Brown, and he talks like John Brown. So they jailed him and put him on trial. And so the play unfolds musically as a courtroom struggle about whether what John Brown did and didn't do, and whether white supremacy is already over because slavery's done or not. So there's a lot of humor, and they eventually has a plot twist, and he brings together black and white farmers to help him escape and help them resolve a pipeline fight. So it's an unusual sort of twist, but it's a way to sort of learn about the past and help make it relevant to the present.
I think part of the problem in people, you know, the stories of revolutionary figures. John Brown was a revolutionary figure in the United States. And, you know, as were the leaders of slave rebellions, for example, you know, and other areas. And he did it on the grounds that there was no lawful system that was regulating the conflict between, you know, the slave and other emerging interests in the country, not to mention homesteading and all the other issues related to people migrating westward and commercializing, you know, the whole project as well with the railroads. So, you know, I think that certain times transformations in society generate, you know, the kind of conflicts in which revolutionary figures turn out to be quite prophetic, and other times in which their voices are, well, you know, it's not going to happen now, so I'm not going to worry about that. You know, but then, you know, if things start to undergo a period of decline, sustained decline, as has been the case pretty much since about 1972, either flat or in decline, for, you know, the median working class person. And that's, you know, that's a long time. And I was listening, for example, to the folk song of the day that fellow named Oliver, can't remember what his last name is, they played his song with the Republican debate the other night. Mm-hmm. The fury in that thing, you're looking at something that's been cooking for a couple of generations, you know, in the many different parts of the country and in different ways. I read an article this morning about how, you know, African Americans need to get more energized. You know, I mean, a pitch to strengthen. Why isn't Biden getting more credit for he's being the best union president in history, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And so this soulful situation where people are losing confidence in the ability to resolve these differences that are becoming more intolerable, you know, all of a sudden, you know, a drama about John Brown, you know, starts to move people. As it would, you know, you could go back to the earlier revolutionary period too and find similar things. But the one in John Brown is interesting because it's right at the kernel of the most difficult schism in the working families, which is on race.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a wonderful project. It'd be interesting to find a way to produce it, you know, here in the county someplace, okay, and get some people from the community to play a part.
Yeah, what I'm working on now is the script is written. The music has been, I got some good help from some really great musicians. You know, the music is all written. And so I'm talking to people in a few different places about potentially the next step being like a dramatic reading of the show, not a fully staged piece, but it requires, like in this play, it requires four black and five white actors who can sing. But I think that to put it down in Harper's Ferry in that area would be really, really outstanding because, you know, the story is really based there in many ways, but even though it's got broader implications. So, you know, people who are interested in just need to reach out to me and see if it's possible. I'm not the producer, I'm the playwright, but people would have to be willing to sort of get a group together, work with a theater group, or put it together on their own, and set it up as a reading as a next step. So I'm I'm in that process right now with a few different folks, and it's a play that needs to happen. You know, it's a story that needs to be told.
There are active theater groups in both Shepherdstown and in Martinsburg. By the way, in Martinsburg, a year from now, there's a big project, actually, that the town undertook, which is to convert the ancient roundhouse, which used to be the place where trains would come in and turn around, and and they had a big I don't remember all the exact roles of the roundhouse, but anyway, they're turning it into a major kind of museum display and memorial, which is going to include a memorial to the 1877 National Railroad strike.
Oh,
that's originated in Martinsburg, West Virginia.
That's right.
I haven't researched it, but there's probably I don't think I'm mistaken that there's going to be a black-white issue in that strike that is going to end up being an interesting thing to find a way to integrate, you know, even though historically I'm sure it involves the persistence of segregation.
That's interestingly that that strike was settled, quote, settled after an enormous amount of violence. Talk about the use of violence against the workers, who actually had to pick up guns themselves to avoid getting shot. And there's a famous quote from that period from Jay Gould, who was quite a big railroad and finance guy, saying, "I could hire one half of the working class to shoot the other half down." It's really sort of indicative of the attitude then and now of a lot of employers, you know.
So it could be an opportunity. There's going to be a big thing. We're going to take that up at the Eastern Regional Central Labor Council here, I think, in September, actually, as part of our Labor Day. But this is a year in advance. I mean, they're still working on this thing. So it would be an opportunity to, get our members involved and take some really important parts of West Virginia history and highlight them, because we know we have all these we're being ruled currently by I don't know what you want to call them, a bunch of vultures that are currently leading the Republican Party in West Virginia. But
John, I wonder if this is a good moment to for me to just play a little clip from the show to give people
why
a
don't
flavor.
You? I think it's good. Can you? I think I have it. You have share screen privileges.
All right. So let me.
You should be able to see share screen, and you should be able to.
All right. My wife here is going to help me. Let's see. Share whiteboard.
Share screen. I have you as co-host, so you should be able to.
Yeah, it looks like there's a share screen.
Okay. Let's pull up the. Hang on a second. Let me just pull up the. Where's the?
There it is. It's all set. It's all ready.
Okay.
And then go back to Zoom. So while we're working on this, I'll just say that this is a song that takes place in the courtroom. They've arrested John Brown. They put him into court, and he gets in an argument with the judge. And the judge is trying to keep order in the court. It's a female judge. And she says to him, "Mr. Brown, we're going to have order in this court. And if you're not going to behave yourself, we'll hang you again." And so this is sort of a comical moment where Brown jumps up and sings this song, "You Can't Hang the Same Man Twice." So you want to do it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you hear it?
Yeah.
Let me give you some advice. I will make
turn up a little bit.
You were bound to respect. Don't fight it, just write it. It's time to decide it. I'm back to say there's more than I expect. Now I may be a ghost or a vision, or I may be your worst nightmare. Don't abuse or refuse, or you I will accuse. I'll be sitting. Some advice, I will make it real concise. You say I'll pay the ultimate price. You can put a man on trial, they can walk that extra mile, but you can't hang the same man twice. It ain't right, but you can't hang the same man twice. You can't hang the same man twice.
That's just a little sample. And he's up dancing in the courtroom while this is happening. He turns it into a square dance, and the judge is pounding her gavel for order. And at any rate, it's a fun part of the story.
Well, I think it'd be interesting to see if we could get some theater folks interested in it. I was going to ask you, one of the difficult transitions for trade union people is what to do about politics.
Mm-hmm.
And, people aren't hired into, factories or workplaces based on their political belief usually. And so you get the workforce as it is. It makes it difficult for labor to act in united way because the actual common ground is, in a spontaneous level without a whole lot of work is minimal. Okay. If it's widespread and you have the potential for really large scale solidarity, well, then it's a superpower. Nothing can overwhelm anything. But at rest, so to speak, there's a lot of competing interests involved, and modern capitalism makes the opportunities and the risks pretty unpredictable for so many families, right? So I keep thinking about back, for example, I think about 1870, Marx and Engels wrote a prescription for what was then the International Working Men's Association about what its current state was and what its future state should be. And its current state was, pretty descriptive of, you find labor fighting a defensive and unequal contest against forces that have much greater range of potential power than they do, except under extraordinary circumstances, and how in the future, the principles of trade unionism that are also principles of socialism, was his argument, were simple. And it was that you don't leave anybody behind and you find something for everyone to do.
Right.
And then
Marx actually said at one point, during the pre-Civil War, or maybe it was during the Civil War, that speaking to white workers, he said that something to the effect that labor can never be free in a white skin while it's enchained in the black skin, you know. Right. And that's a lesson that we're still learning. And yep. Actually, one of the things that happens in my recent musical with John Brown is that the protagonist is a white farmer, and he's about to lose his land to a pipeline company. And all he's got is his land. He's got a house on it, and he grew up there, and his wife had died. And the pipeline company, which is called Smoke and Mirrors, is also trying to take the black farmer's land in the area. But the white farmer won't talk to them. So, well, we don't really talk to those people. And so part of what John Brown's mission ends up being in the play is convincing this guy to unite actually with the black farmers and save their land. And that's part of his escape plan also. So it's he confronts the guy at one point and says, are you trying to tell me that you would lose your land and your house, the only thing you really have in the world to pass on to your son, rather than talk to these black farmers? And so eventually this white farmer changes and realizes that that's a mistake. And that's a mistake that we see happening. There's a lot of confusion around that with this, some of the backlash against talking about our own history. But I think that the play tries to illustrate why it's really not in the self-interest of white workers to be white as opposed to being workers.
Yeah, that's a as a great cartoon that I used to use in on that subject, where you have three people sitting at a table. You got the boss sitting at one end, and you got a white worker on one side and a black worker on the other side, and they're talking about the cookies, how we're going to divide up the cookies. And the boss has all the cookies except for one, which is sitting on the white worker's plate. And the boss is telling the white worker, watch out, he wants to take your cookie.
Right. Yeah. That's exactly it, So, but I think, if we look at some of the things that's happening, like this UPS strike, for example, or not strike, but almost strike, in that whole campaign and getting 350,000 workers involved. This was a really, like a lot of workplaces like that, a totally diverse group of workers of every color, size, men and women. And they had one thing in common. They all work for the same employer. But I think that, the challenge for labor leaders, I think, is that is to take advantage of those kind of moments, not just on the practical fact of getting people out on the picket line or whatever at the demonstration, but to sort of point out and educate people about who the real enemy is. Because the problem with the right is they want to say the enemy are some liberal politicians. And really, we know the truth is the enemy, and you can see it at a time like that for UPS. The enemy was the owners of UPS and the board and the investors, just like it is at UAW. And that's what we have to unite against in this country, not some one politician or another,
I thought it
strikes at times to do it.
Well, I think that illustrated some important one is a very practical one is that if you prepare good preparation for a strike is almost as powerful, if not more powerful, than the strike itself. Mm-hmm. And I think that when UPS took on, when the Teamsters took on UPS in the last contract, partly they did it, you know, because they were told by management, you'll never be able to have a strike vote anyway, you know. Mm-hmm. And they actually went out and proved to themselves that you could, if you went out and started it, you could get people to act. And then they spent this whole time on this letter time being really serious about it, because they didn't make as much progress on the basic issues as they needed to make, especially on the part-timers. And so it really does show that, and it shows the temper of the people has changed. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's and it's begs a question. I mean, back when Jim Mattis was still, you know, an officer of the UE, I think one of the last speeches he made actually was, you know, calling on the leadership of the AFL-CIO, you know, confronting what was happening in the late 70s with the labor board and everything else. You know, put it to the rank and file to vote on it, but shut the whole effing thing down. Mm-hmm. You know, and don't let this thing get going. You know, the consequences of Taft-Hartley, basically, you know, just becoming now, at that point, fully realized. And but of course, and it seemed like, you know, Jim was doing the IWW thing at that moment in his retirement speech. But nonetheless, the question is now there. You talk about I think it made a big difference, for example, when Biden in the UPS negotiation, unlike he got roped into it in the railroad thing, which I think he heard backlash from. And so he put hands off on the Teamsters pretty much. And or at least he through Jared Bernstein, he did. And he was a good guy, by the way. And so it's very interesting, you know, and I imagine Biden will pay a price now, because you could tell that UPS said was being told, you got nowhere to go. You got to bargain a contract. Mm-hmm. They did. So you're talking about how important the leverage, the national leverage is, though. You know, with the fact that Biden did take hands off of that one, or at least he said so. And I can't believe that the UPS, that they got the message. That was
I think that part of the problem is that what happened then and is happening now at UAW is unfortunately unusual for the labor movement, that particularly when there's a Democrat in, the labor movement is really reluctant to put pressure on the president, you know, and generally, you know, don't push him beyond his limits and beyond the limits of what the Democratic Party wants. I think that UPS was different, and I think the message coming out of the UAW is different too, president is basically saying, look, you know, there's all these changes going on. We're going to be producing batteries and electric cars and cars all over the South and all that kind of stuff. And so you can't be giving away billions of public dollars to companies to produce these electric kind of vehicles and parts where they don't have any kind of labor requirements. It's just not, we're not going to accept that. And he wasn't being nice about it. He wasn't being rude about it, but he's being very frank that we're calling out the government to like do what it says it needs to do. And so we have another battle in front of us with the UPS folks. I think some of the same stuff is happening and will happen even more around the Amazon workers, pushing both the National Labor Relations Board and also the president and the Democratic Party and so on, that, you know, we can't just say that it's okay what Amazon does while it mistreats its workers big time. You need to sort of pick sides. You know, are you going to enforce the law around labor and labor rights, or are you going to pretend that that doesn't matter and keep doing business with all these companies? That's a pressure point that we have that we don't often use, but it seems to be being used now.
Well, you have two fundamental points of view there that are in conflict. I mean, one is that Amazon is too big to fail, and therefore, that would be, they would certainly use their force to make that known. They haven't recognized anybody yet, and I don't think they're going to. That's another issue, really. I mean, the organization of something as big as Amazon really would require a government order saying you can't have a fair election process. It's not even possible. Therefore, there's a directed order to bargain, period.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're going to have to do. And I see the Teamsters have taken probably the only reasonable strategic approach, which is to focus on the fact that this thing has got to have trucking and air going in and out. Okay. And so it's a pressure point that they can influence, right? Easier than some others, right? Just than the straight warehouse operations and stuff. So if they have leverage, then if somebody has leverage, then you have to go to that. But I just don't think that the NLRB, as currently constituted, is going to be the primary way that has to go.
There are some very helpful cases. I agree with you. There are some very helpful cases out there, including one that just got ruled on by the board in the last couple of days, called Chemex, CEMEX. That increases the pressure on employers to either accept a union or risk having a contract bargaining order that is sort of been out there for a while and has sort of been reissued. And there's some other important ones, like for Amazon in particular. One of the ways they won in Staten Island was using the break rooms. The workers would not only meet during their breaks, which often weren't very long, but workers after the shifts were done would come back into the plant, into the break rooms, and talk to workers again. And Amazon put the kibosh on that. That's also before the board. So there's a few things that they can help. But in the end, it's got to be shop floor power that really moves the thing. And the good news is that there are a lot of initiatives. The Teamsters, there's a group called Amazonians United. Other unions are involved. And there's a lot of bottom-up energy and activity among young workers. So it's going to take all of that and more.
Right. So, but for example, suppose you had national bargaining rights for 1 million Amazon workers. What's your attitude toward Amazon as a business? And should, for example, the German model of inviting or permitting employee representatives to sit on the board of directors of the corporation?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the kind of empowerment? Is that we're talking about a virtual monopoly, right? At least in the United States. And is that something that the union should do? But then, of course, everybody that's working for the company is also selling for the company.
Yeah.
It's a little complicated. And does it matter whether, the work is intellectual or service and personality driven or just production?
All of this at Amazon in particular?
Well, I think Amazon, yeah. But it's the one, probably any of the big tech companies, actually, because they're actually global. Facebook has 4.5 billion accounts. 4.5 billion accounts, and it profiles every single one of them.
Yeah. So with Amazon, there's a lot of organizing happening in Europe. Last year at the big day, Amazon or Prime Day right before Thanksgiving, there were actions of some kind in India, in a number of places in Europe, and a bunch of locations in the United States. Not big walkouts in this country, but and also the tech workers in their headquarters are very active and are in communication with the warehouse workers. And then there's a bunch of people working on sort of political legislative accountability stuff around safety and health, around antitrust. There are places where people are fighting the installation of new Amazon warehouses. And so I think it's going to take all of that and more to really create a situation where Amazon has to be accountable. And I think that everybody's got an interest in that, because the Amazon model is so dominant, and not just in their warehouses when they're drivers, but even on the internet. You watch Netflix at night, you're watching it on Amazon wireless services. Big government agencies, state agencies, all of their internet is tied to Amazon wireless service, which is actually their profit center. And then they got their movie stuff in Amazon Prime and so on. So this is a company that wants to sort of essentially be the government, except, you know, take no responsibility. So we need a massive labor and community, a broad-based movement to like really define what the role of a company like this should be, you know.
But that's the hard part, because I'm not sure. For example, in China, the Chinese Communist Party said, if you're going to have all these profiles, we're going to have them too. And so we're going to appoint somebody, a political officer, I don't know what they call it, whatever. They're going to appoint somebody to be on the leadership of Tencent or Alibaba. Actually, they recruited Jack Ma to do it for them, I think. You know, but and thereby the state in that situation is ultimately responsible informed about what they're doing. Now here, or in Europe or wherever, I mean, I see there's a lot of legal court action in Europe, you know, over this issue of intellectual property, and especially user property. Is it their property? I mean, is the things you say and do over the internet, is that your property? That's a philosophical question that's becoming pretty difficult, because the minute you say it is your property, well, now you've imposed upon that structure, probably, especially since it's global, an unenforceable demand. It doesn't matter what you do, it's going to leak. So I'm not sure what the solution is beyond some form of nationalization for those type of enterprises. I'm not quite sure what that form should be, or whether it needs to be complete or partial or whatever. I mean, ultimately, you're having a private entity in control of billions, trillions of dollars. And there's a risk. It's doing it for profit. And the fact that it's doing it for profit means, well, it may profit or it may lose due to internal or external factors. And if it loses, who picks up the tab? Because now it's infrastructure. And so how do they pick up the tab if they don't own, if they're not in it? You know, see, that's... And you can't convince any of these Wall Street guys. I remember they interviewed Jamie Dimon the other day, and about an interviewer from Bloomberg, no less, was asking him, are you too big to fail? Right after they, consumed the Silicon Valley and a bunch of other assets. And he says, gee, you know, I don't quite know what that means. And because why? Well, because to a Wall Streeter, you know, a failure is just an opportunity.
So I think, you know, I definitely don't think they're too big to fail. I think that that ultimately there has to be through the worker organizing and the political organizing and the kind of regulations that they're doing in Europe, where, for example, you know, they can't just sell your data without certain kinds of permission. You have, and in Europe, you have the right to be erased. So you can go to Facebook in Europe and say, everything in the before last year, I want removed from any access to anybody. It's my life. You can't have it. So there's a lot of these kind of regulations being introduced there, and Amazon's being fined, not just Amazon, Facebook, so on, being fined millions of dollars. I feel like we, you know, right now, the way the Facebook model, for example, is that it's not so much that they run us, it's that they've turned us into their data, you know? So God forbid you should post something about your new shoes on Facebook. All of a sudden, you're going to start getting ads from 50 shoe companies, right? Sure. So they sort of own our entire profile. And of course, when the political season comes around, that's really powerful to just steal everybody's profile and figure out how to manipulate them with what kind of ads.
Or so, how to pick the winner, or how to pick the winners, you know?
How to pick the winner, right. So I feel like that it's not clear what you're getting at, how it ultimately will sort of we can hem them in, but I think that for this, at this point, we need to build a substantial organizing base to really motivate that publicly, and I think starting with the workers that work there. But also there are many unions, there are many progressive organizations that see the writing on the wall, the way Amazon's going to be able to dictate which books get published. Because if Amazon doesn't agree to advertise your book, your sales could get done, cut down in a third, right? Et cetera, et cetera. And we just can't let them do it. So, and on my part, I'm doing some of that work with some of these workers, but you know, the reason I did this play and I've been doing this theater is that I feel like the cultural work is a really important method of sort of changing people's awareness. Not everybody reads the New York Times, even if that's a good source, or various left publications, you know. Yeah. But what I found is that, and this is quite a history in the working class going back into pre-World War II in the 30s, when theater was political theater, strike theaters, theater under the, you know, all the programs of the New Deal that they were funded. You can communicate and educate while you're entertaining. I found it really encouraging with the last play I did, The Moment Was Now, which was all done in music and rap and history and sort of talking about all the different political forces. It was sort of complicated, but really radical in the way that taking their own words of the players at that time who were looking at these big questions, like William Silvers was a part of the International Working Men's Association. He was a lefty ironworker guy, and he talked about the ruling class and so on. And so we put that, his words, into songs, and we see the audience clapping to the songs about the ruling class and the Wall Streeters and the corporate cheaters, that if you had read that from as a speech, people might boo or walk out, you know. And so we are so tied to a commercial culture that's all for profit that we don't get that kind of exposure. And so I sort of look for opportunities to sort of see if we can create some of that kind of cultures. And there's other folks in the DC area that have done some really good work through the Labor Heritage Foundation. But we've got a great history, an amazing history. As ugly as it is, there's in some ways, there's some really inspiring moments of many kinds, and people don't learn the latter part. And that's what the big fight is about, is that what is the narrative? Who gets to tell our history? And the right wing wants to tell our history in a way that it doesn't reflect reality. And what we're trying to do is tell the real history, because that your interpretation of that narrative is part of determining who we are. And if you understand who we really are, that can shape policy and your values and the kind of conversations that people have. And I think culture has a real role to play in all that.
I think that's a good way to sign off here, Gene. And I just want to say that I hope we can put together. I'll get you a list of some producers around here and see what. I guess you'd have to take it from there, see if they're interested. But and I'll certainly raise it at the Labor Council that it's a potential cultural event that could be associated with the.
I would just say anybody that wants to reach me, GeneBruskin@gmail.com. Right. And what I found most helpful so far in terms of opportunities to produce my various plays is when people can connect me to somebody who they know. Because as a non-famous playwright, when I send a script to Shepherdstown or someplace like that, it just goes into the, you know, a junk box, really. Contacts somebody and says, this guy you ought to talk to, that's a huge help. And I really welcome that help from everybody.
All right. Well, we'll seek those kind of folks to see if any other one can get a hold of you. All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, John.
Labor Beat Radio. And we usually get this up same day, if not next, on. Please go to podcasts.enlightenradio.org. That's where these podcasts are listed. They're also listed on democracyroad.podbean.com. Our player is usually running 24/7 at player.enlightenradio.org. So hope to you guys check in. By the way, our change time. Note that Labor Beat Radio, as well as the other shows on Enlightened Radio during the week, are starting at 10 a.m. Now. And all right, everybody, take care of each other. It's late.
Thanks for having me, John. And bye, everybody. Have a great day, folks.
All right. Bye-bye. Take care.